This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If there is ever a zombie attack, the person most likely to survive just might be my guest Max Brooks, who's the son of Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft. Max Brooks is the author of The Zombie Survival Guide and World War Z, An Oral History of the Zombie Wars. These books are fictional manifestations of his own fears and anxieties and his impulse to overcome them by preparing for the worst. He's done so much research on preparing for widespread catastrophe that he's been invited to participate in an Army WMD preparedness exercise. And he's now a fellow at the Modern War Institute at West Point. He's also very funny, in spite of all the doomsday scenarios he's preoccupied with. His new novel, Minecraft: The Island, is a novelization of the incredibly popular video game Minecraft. Max Brooks, welcome to Fresh Air. Describe the premise of Minecraft: The Island.
Minecraft: The Island is a novel based on the video game Minecraft. Minecraft the game, for anyone who hasn't played it or who has children and has not asked them, what are you doing on the iPad? It is not so much a game in the literal form, because there's not really a goal except to survive. It is a virtual world of blocks where you literally have to not starve and build a house and not get killed by creatures who come out after dark. And that is really the premise of this book, where someone from our world wakes up in that world and swims to an island and has to survive on the island. So it's like the movie Tron meets Robinson Crusoe. And as this person is surviving and doing basic life skills, they are learning real life skills of wisdom, patience, planning, preparation, how to deal with failure, how to learn from your mistakes, lessons they can take back to their world.
So this book, the Minecraft book, and your zombie books are about surviving when the old rules no longer apply. And your zombies were infected by a virus, the Selenium virus, that spread through contact with body fluids. And you've said that that was partly inspired by the AIDS epidemic. How old were you when you first heard about AIDS?
I think I must have been about 12. I was literally coming into puberty just when I was told that puberty could kill me.
What effect did that have on you?
Well, I think it would be lying if I said that it made me neurotic, but I think it would be pretty accurate. Yes, the fire was smoldering, but I think this was the super tanker that exploded onto the smoldering flame that was my genetic neurosis.
And the fact that you write zombie books and the Minecraft book that's all about being in this kind of alien environment and your only goal is to survive, does that describe what your inner psychological state was like when you were growing
up? Yeah, I think you nailed it. I think the notion of learning how to survive when the old world rules no longer apply, it pretty much sums up everything I write about. It's really the crux of my work. I write a lot about change. And I write about my characters having to adapt to external changes that they did not choose and do not necessarily want.
So what are some of the other external changes you had to navigate through during your formative years?
Well, I think there's the standard one of leaving home. And I think it's pretty much happened to most 18 to 20-something-year-olds when they go out into the world and they realize that perhaps everything they learned in their house doesn't apply to the outside world and they have to write a whole new rule book. And I think that that has pretty much gone into hyperdrive now, or as my father would say, ludicrous speed, because the world is changing so quickly now that pretty much everything I've learned as a parent is useless to my child. And so the notion of it's not what you learn, but it's how you learn, I think, is the only way you can parent nowadays.
Did the fact that your parents, Anne Bancroft and Mel Brooks, were famous, they had money, give you any sense of security?
Oh, God, no. 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 As a matter of fact, that worked against us, because my parents were a generation removed. I'm a Gen Xer, and most Gen Xers had baby boomer parents. So most Gen Xers experienced sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and their parents experienced sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was just a different version of it. Whereas my parents was Hitler and the Depression.
And World War II, because your father fought in World War II.
Yes, my father actually fought against Hitler. And so, for example, my mother's greatest event of her adolescence was not kissing a boy or going to the prom. It was going to the movies with her sisters, and suddenly the movie stopped, and somebody came out onto the stage and said, "We regret to inform you the Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor. We are now at war."
So between the Holocaust and your mother's experience of World War II, not to mention the Depression, were you brought up thinking that at any moment the apocalypse could happen?
Well, I think growing up in Los Angeles in the 1980s was pretty apocalyptic because, you know, if you remember, the 80s tried to very much emulate the 50s, except for things like crack and AIDS and gangs. We did have the good old 1950s resurgence of nuclear war fear. Remember The Day After? That was fun. We had that great miniseries The Day After that kids were told not to watch. And also specifically living in Los Angeles is always on the edge of the apocalypse. We've had constant fires, floods, zero infrastructure. I grew up watching my friends' houses slide down the hills into the canyons. I watched the hills just burn up.
I think you left out earthquakes.
Oh, yes, those too. And that was pretty formative for my zombie work, because really my zombie work is just disaster preparedness. My mother had an earthquake kit, and we would have to go through it, and we would have to train for it, and we would have to have earthquake drills. And my mother talked about if there was an earthquake, we would eat the dog. So
seriously?
We always had, yes, oh yes. I brought my beautiful young girlfriend over, who's now my wife, to dinner with my parents, and the Northridge quake had happened. And we discussed what we would do. And I was saying, well, maybe we could eat the fish in the koi pond. And so my mother had to, of course, one-up me and say, well, we could always eat Purdy. And that was our dog.
So you did a lot of research for the zombie books and the Minecraft book to see what kinds of things you could do to survive. Did you apply any of those from your own life? Or did any of those come from your own life?
Everything I do is based on research. My hero is not James Joyce, it's Tom Clancy. Because as a kid growing up with dyslexia, I loved being able to learn from my fiction. So I loved setting down a book I had read and feeling educated as well as entertained. So everything I do has to be based in reality. And in the Zombie Survival Guide, half of it is book learned and half of it is life learned. When I talk about the M16 being a horrible jamming weapon, that's based on my own personal experience in Army ROTC. And I can tell you as a fact, the M16 was never meant to be a frontline infantry combat weapon. It was meant to be an Air Force-based security weapon. So mud, dirt, and suddenly click and jam, and it blows up in your face.
Yes, so you were in ROTC, which is, you know, a military leadership training program on college campuses. And it kind of amazes me that you did ROTC training. When you're so afraid of disaster, you're basically signing yourself up to go fight in a war, should there be one.
Well, I think that fits with my philosophy that you can't wall yourself off from danger. Danger is coming for you. So you can either be proactive and prepare for it and face it, or you can hide in a hole until the threat digs down into the hole after you.
So you signed up for ROTC in order to get more preparedness?
No, I signed up for ROTC because like a good young liberal, I thought that America was very good to me, and America had given, and it was my turn to give back.
How were you in the training? Are you
probably the worst soldier in the history of the United States Army?
Okay, I'm going to quote two things from your zombie book. These are like takeaway lessons. One is, fear can be conquered. Anxiety must be endured. That's actually very funny.
That's very true. That's from Minecraft the Island, where the character on this island realizes that fear represents an actual threat. Fear is a threat you can actually face, conquer. You can be proactive and deal with it. But anxiety is the threat of the threat. Anxiety is thinking about the threat.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's really no way to conquer anxiety except just to get through it and go on about your life. And that's a philosophy I live with.
Okay, so one more. Panic drowns thought. So true. So how have you dealt with anxiety and panic in your life?
Well, I have a lot of experience in that. My family really are refugees from the land of panic, because that's been the philosophy in my family. I don't know if you remember this movie, History of the World.
Oh, yeah, I love it.
Where the refugees are, they're trying to get out of Rome, and my father's character says, "Don't panic, don't panic, don't panic." And then the legionary goes, "There they are." And then he just says, "Panic!" Welcome to my childhood. We always had these moments, you know, because also remember, my parents went into the fame bubble in their early 20s, late teens, in the late 1940s. And America went through such drastic changes that they really had no coping mechanisms for the modern world of crime, drugs, social disintegration. I mean, the notion that John Lennon could be shot by somebody who loved him, that was incomprehensible when they were kids.
Did having a son change your perspective on not only survival, but on being steady? You know, having some kind of confidence that you could pass on to your son.
Yeah, I think it did. I think that any sort of nihilistic adolescent thoughts I had really had to go. There's no room. When you choose to bring a life into the world, it's got to be about them. And I think I felt the weight of every decision I ever made, every word I ever said. And if there's anything to focus you and make you think long term, it's having a child. You know, I just learned recently from a very close family friend that my late mother, who, by the way, had cancer when I was little and had beaten it, said to her best friend, "I just have to live long enough for Max to be able to take care of himself." And so she did. And when she passed away, I was in my 30s and I had just had a baby, literally 2 months. I was a father. And so that's sort of the deal that I think. I've just got to survive long enough to let my little boy fly.
No, it's interesting to me that you've actually worked with the military on preparedness. And it's kind of amazing that they'd be turning to the zombie fiction writer guy to help them in preparing for biochemical and nuclear attacks. So what is or has your role been?
My role has been to work with an organization called the Modern War Institute, which is a think tank located at West Point. And what we do is study modern conflict. And what I do within the Modern War Institute is try to identify military threats in a non-military forum. For example, I wrote an article on Monsanto, where everyone is so worried about GMOs as far as the health concerns, but I looked at GMOs from a geostrategic concern. Last year, Monsanto was sold to Bayer. Now, Monsanto, because of the 2014 Supreme Court decision, has patented the genes, the rights, for 90% of our soybeans and 80% of our corn, which means that farmers, for the first time since the agricultural revolution, cannot buy their seeds. They have to buy their seeds every year. They cannot bank their seeds and replant them. They have to go back to Monsanto every year. Now, that was bad enough when Monsanto was American. And even though we have treaties, security treaties with the Germans, with Bayer, there is nothing to stop that German company from selling it to China. And so theoretically now, legally, China could blackmail us with food the same way OPEC blackmailed us with oil in the 1970s.
Wow, I'd certainly never heard of or thought of that.
No, what I do is I look at all the pieces that everyone else already has in front of them, but I see them arranged in a certain fashion. And that is, I think, probably because of neurosis, but I think it's probably also because of dyslexia, because I've never been able to learn in a linear fashion. I've had to dig deep and truly understand the subjects that I'm tackling if I'm ever going to get past them. And so it allows me to see avenues that other people might have missed.
Well, you've said that you also have obsessive compulsive disorder. Does OCD play into it too?
Oh, yeah, because when I am passionate about something, I am extremely passionate about something. I will study it to the nth degree. Unfortunately, by the same token, when I am not passionate about something, oh, good Lord, my wife and I have an agreement when she says to me, "Listen, if you're coming out to a social engagement, you better agree, because I will not have you sitting there surly in a corner, rolling your eyes at some other husband talking about sports. You are not allowed to do that." Because the truth is, if I'm not interested, I will get up and leave the room. I will say, I'm sorry, I know that you're very passionate about whatever, your car or the shoes you're wearing, but I'm not going to be on this planet for another 70 years, and I can't waste the extra 90 seconds hearing about your shoes or your car.
How did the military get on to you? What made them think that you were going to be a valuable player in preparedness training?
It all started on a risk where the president of the United States Naval War College asked me to come in and give a talk. I came in and I spoke on interconnectivity. And I talked about how in the 1940s, we understood as a nation that everything was connected. We understood that nutrition, education, infrastructure, all trickled down to national defense. For example, you know how we built our highways. We built our national highway system literally because in case our air bases got nuked, we would have millions of miles of paved runways for our planes to land. We talked about how nutrition meant that our soldiers would be healthy. Education, our soldiers would understand their training. And I talked about how we had lost all that and that the military was in its own little bubble and that everything else was eroding on the other side. And from that lecture, I was invited to speak again and again and again. Until finally I was at a strategic studies group and I gave that lecture and I gave it a final button and I said, you better take care of your veterans in this war because my generation grew up with the streets literally paved with Vietnam veterans. And we don't care how many commercials you throw at us. When you see a legless drug addict in a cardboard box wearing an old Vietnam Army jacket, you know that that's what is waiting for you if you serve your country. And if you don't take care of our vets, you'll never get new soldiers. In the back of the room was a young Army captain who had just got back from Iraq hearing me talk. And when he was invited to start the Modern War Institute, be one of the founders, he invited me to come along.
That's such an interesting story and such an interesting perception about how people won't sign up. Well, what they see of veterans is people who are homeless and legless and kind of begging for money and food.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is exactly the difference between me and most of my generation, because I grew up with greatest generation parents. And so my father, you know, the great Mel Brooks, it doesn't matter how successful he is. If you get him and Carl Reiner and some of his friends from that generation together, eventually the talk will turn to how they served their country. That was their formative years. When I was 20 years old, I was a young production assistant for Don Rickles on his TV show, Daddy Dearest. And what he liked to talk about was serving on a PT boat in the Battle of Leyte Gulf. So to them, I saw all these successful, accomplished grown-ups who looked at national service as something to be proud of.
Have you found it very validating to have the military, or at least part of the military, turning to you to think of scenarios that we should be planning for? You know, it's one thing to use your fears and your panic and neuroses to write like zombie books, which is, you know, a pretty wonderful thing to do. But it's a whole different level to be working with the military on actual preparedness.
Well, what's validating about it is for the first time in my life, really be surrounded by a group of genuinely patriotic intellectuals. You know, we have this myth in our country that the warrior class is somehow either made up of people too poor to do anything but serve, or they're crazed rednecks who like to blow stuff up. And yet I'm surrounded on a constant basis by people who are highly educated, highly motivated, come from good families, did not have to serve, chose out of a love of country, and go to work every day and talk about issues like gender equality and education for little girls in certain countries, getting the sewer systems working in megacities, and climate change, how to purify human waste so it doesn't make cholera, and what's going to happen when the polar ice caps melt, and that means a naval buildup in the Arctic. So all the issues that you would think liberal NGOs would be talking about are talked about every day by people in uniform.
So you grew up with Anne Bancroft and Mel Brooks as your parents, two very famous, very acclaimed people in the movie business. Did your father test out jokes or story ideas on you when you were young?
Absolutely not. You know, you have to remember that my father came from a generation where if you put a roof over your head and food on the table, you're father of the year. My father also, you know, my dad didn't also have a dad. My father's father died of tuberculosis when my father was 2 years old. So this sort of new agey notion that a dad is also a pal, that was not in my house. What I did get from my father was stability. And I'm very grateful for that, because as a lot of my Gen Xer colleagues will tell you, their baby boomer parents were not home, were out partying, were getting divorce after divorce, were coming home with new girlfriends and just saying, hey, this is your new mom, I think. Whereas my father was home every night at 7 o'clock with my mother and having dinner, and we had a stable life, which I think sort of set the tone for my life, in that my wife and I have dinner with our child at home at a certain time every day. And then my dad shows up.
Did you think your father's films were funny?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. No, my dad's films. Look, I always get asked, you know, did you think your father was funny? Was he always that funny? And the truth is, I always say to people when they say, what was it like growing up with Mel Brooks? I say, you have to give me a frame of reference. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your father, and then I'll tell you if it was anything like my father. I think one of my light bulb moments was when I was dating my girlfriend, now my wife, and we went to the retirement party of a family friend where they did a little skit. And I looked at the skit, and I looked at my girlfriend, and I said, wow, normal people aren't that funny. Because, you know, my father wasn't always funny. You know, I would have to say that 70-80% of the time, he didn't come home as Mr. Funny Man. He came home as this very stressed, overworked man, self-made man who'd risen himself out of extreme poverty and had built an empire of comedy and was trying to maintain that in an ever-changing world of morphing tastes. Mm-hmm. And so I saw the stress, I saw the panic, I saw the man who was watching studio heads change and friends die off, and the economics of show business change, and him always trying to stay one step ahead. That's what I saw. And I think that was I'm glad I had that. I would much rather have that, because that taught me that no matter how easy it looks on the screen, it's a job. And it is no easier than any other job. And I was very, very lucky when we did the audiobook of Minecraft the Island. We had two different readers, a man and a woman, Samira Wiley from Orange is the New Black and Handmaid's Tale. She read an amazing version of Minecraft the Island. And the male was a guy I went to high school with, Jack Black.
You went to high school with him? Oh, wow.
I went to high school with Jack. We were in a school play together. And so he agreed to read the male version of Minecraft the Island. So we went to the studio, me and my son, who loves him, loves Kung Fu Panda. Now, Jack was struggling because, in his words, he's a little bit dyslexic and his tongue is too big for his mouth. So it was a priceless teaching moment for my son to watch his hero, have to keep going, have to do take after take until he got it right. And then once he's pleased, the audio engineer has to please himself and say, no, 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 I can do that better. And to say to my son, you see, this is a job. This isn't just all happy, fun talent time. Talent is 10%. And so watching Jack Black for my son was a little bit like me watching my father have to grind it out over the course of my childhood.
Mm-hmm. And so what about your mother, Anne Bancroft? She was a great actress. And like The Miracle Worker and The Graduate were such formative films for so many people in such different ways. You know, she's this incredibly patient, wise teacher, teaching Helen Keller in The Miracle Worker, and in The Graduate, of course, she's having an affair with somebody who just graduated college, and it's actually the boyfriend of her daughter. So, you know, the classic Mrs. Robinson. What impact did those films have on you, seeing your mother in both of those roles?
Well, I would tell you that as far as The Graduate goes, I didn't see it until I was about 22 years old because I was afraid. I thought, oh, my God, what if I... Because my whole life, creepy baby boomers had been coming up to me and saying, you know, oh, your mother, first time I saw her, hey, oi, hey. And so I thought, oh, my God, what if it's this weird psychosexual experience that you can't escape from? And what if I see it and I get aroused? I'll be on the therapist couch the rest of my life. I'll never have a normal relationship. And so finally, as a tradition where I went to college, they watched The Graduate. And I thought, oh, boy, here we go. And I watched it and I thought, oh, this is it? Wow, you baby boomers must have been repressed. But then, as far as you said, the miracle worker, well, she was my miracle worker.
Because, in what respect?
Well, because I had dyslexia. And dyslexia in the late 70s, 1980s was unheard of. Dyslexia was, they didn't even call it a disability back then. It was just laziness, goofing off. You're not trying hard enough. You can do it, but you don't want to do it. That was a big one of my teachers. And my mother, one of the greatest, most successful actresses of her day, gave up her career, put her career on the shelf to raise me and to be my educational advocate and to teach herself about dyslexia and to come up with coping mechanisms and to meet with my teachers every year and make sure that they understood what I was going through and find ways I could learn in a non-traditional format. She took every year all of my school books that I had to read to the Institute for the Blind and had them all read onto audio cassette so I could listen to my reading list. And if I hadn't been able to do that, I wouldn't have graduated high school. I can literally say that not only did my mother give me my life, she saved my life.
Did you know that she was giving up acting for years in order to take care of you and to help you through the dyslexia?
You know, I did, but I really don't think you appreciate a parent's effort until you become one yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I really do think there is a true psychological line between understanding something and getting it. You know, for example, I study war. I literally work at a think tank at West Point studying war. But I ain't never been in it, so I don't get it. I understand it on an intellectual level, but on a deep, visceral level, I don't get it. And I understood on an intellectual level all my mother was doing and all she was giving up to make sure that I could fly. But it wasn't until I had a kid that I really felt deep in my bone marrow what she had done. That was when I got it.
So the dyslexia made it hard for you to read. How do you write with a dyslexia? Does it affect it?
You can thank my mom, because I had the worst handwriting ever. And I remember one teacher tried to shame me in class and say, "Hey, everyone, look at the weird way Max holds his pencil." Gee, thanks, expensive private school. And so my mother, while she was busy fighting with my teachers to tell them that I wasn't just goofing off because I was some celebrity kid, she was also trying to find how technology could help me. And so in eighth grade, she forced me to take a typing class. And I hated it. It was an elective. I said, "Mom, I want to go home. I want to watch cartoons. I want to read comic books. I want to take a typing class." And she said, "Absolutely not. Technology, computers. Computers are the way of the future. You're going to be a writer. This is a writer's tool. You are going to learn how to type so you can be a writer. So you will never have to dictate. So you will never have to be dependent on anyone else. This tool called the computer will make you independent." And that's exactly what happened.
How did she know you were going to be a writer?
I was 12 years old, and we were on vacation in Venice, Italy. And I snuck away into the back of our changing cabana on the beach for 3 days, and I wrote a short story. And for a kid, you know, who was ADD, ADHD, dyslexic, living with a head in the clouds, it was the first time in my whole life that I was 100% focused for three consistent days. And that's when my mom knew, okay, he's on to something.
You know, your father's comedy has always been so entwined with being Jewish. And your mother is, like,
very
your mother
Italian.
Was what, Italian? Yeah.
Oh boy, was she Italian.
So what was your sense of, like, your ethnic heritage from your two parents?
Well, you know, I always felt a little bit of both. I always felt like I'm definitely intellectually Jewish. You know, Jews, we are neurotic. We are questioners. And when fellow Jews would say, "Well, you're not really Jewish because your mother isn't Jewish," I would say to them, "Well, I may not be Jewish enough for Israel, but I'm Jewish enough for Dachau." And that pretty much shut them up. And in fact, I learned from my rabbi when I was getting married that apparently the whole being Jewish on your mother's side, that's not Jewish. That's Roman.
What? Really?
The Romans, who were excellent lawyers, understood that there was no way to prove who your father was. But for legal, for wills, for documents, for estates, you could always prove who your mother was. And so that is how they organized their whole legal standing, according to my rabbi. And so the Jews said, hey, for the first time, we can actually learn from somebody else. And so they adopted it. So I've always felt intellectually Jewish. And you better not say anything anti-Semitic around me, because then I go full Jew. But although I go full Jew as an Italian, my heart, my emotionality, my passion is so Italian. And certainly my wife would agree that the yelling is definitely the Italian side.
It must have been really hard to watch your father survive the loss of your mother.
Oh, it was terrifying. Oh, my God. You want to talk about resilience? Well, you know, we all got lucky. I did, my wife, my father, because we had a little baby. My son was born 2 months before my mother died. So he gave us a purpose. You know, we had this brand new life that this little micro village of the Brooks family had to sort of come around and keep alive with very simple needs: feeding, clothing, sleeping, health, burping. And we could all do that. And I think that saved all of us. You know, it certainly saved my dad. The baby, he would come over and the baby would be in his lap and he would fall asleep on the couch with the baby. The two of them would sleep on the couch together. And he would walk the baby around until he burped, and he would entertain him. And to this day, my father and my son have this amazing relationship. My father comes over every night, and my son can't wait. You know, my wife and I, not every night. Once in a while, it'd be nice to get a break, but my son, he's like, oh, Grandpa, come on. And they love each other. And my son is irreverent, just like my father. And now my father has this protege. And so when my son was pretending to be FDR in his Notable Americans class, he goes, hey, Dad, can I do FDR, a polio comedy? I said, no, you can't do that. And my father said, what? That's hilarious. No one's ever done that. FDR, a polio comedy. You'll love it.
So I want to mention another book that you did, and it's a graphic novel that's set during World War I, and it's about the first African-American regiment to fight in World War I. And one of the people in that regiment, this is like the Harlem Hellfighters, they were from Harlem, and one of the people in that regiment was James Reese Europe, who was a band leader. He was the musical director for the dance team Vernon and Irene Castle. And it's really interesting, and I was wondering why you did a World War I book. It's fiction,
it's a dramatized version of a true story.
Yeah.
And I had been in love with that story since I was 11 years old.
The story of the Harlem Hellfighters?
The story of the Harlem Hellfighters. The story that there was an actual unit of African-American soldiers that had literally been set up to fail by the United States government and had been put in combat hoping that they would come home in disgrace. And they had actually been sabotaged by the U.S. government. Didn't give them proper weapons, didn't give them proper training, sent them to train in Spartanburg, South Carolina, 2 weeks after a horrible race riot in Houston with black soldiers. So they were hoping there would be a race riot. Then wouldn't let them march off to war with the other National Guard units in what was called the Rainbow Division, because they were told, direct quote, black is not a color of the rainbow. Then they were sent over and made to dig ditches. And when they protested and asked to be put in combat, they were given to the French army. And if that wasn't an insult enough, because the American army at the time was very clear, American soldiers will not be fed piecemeal as replacements into a European command structure. They will fight as an American unit under an American flag, .. except for the black guys. You can have them. And if that wasn't bad enough, the U.S. Army actually gave the French Army a memorandum, line by line, on how to import Jim Crow, how to treat them like second-class citizens. And it literally was, don't shake hands with them, don't visit with them socially, don't praise them in the company of white soldiers, don't eat with them, you know, please God, don't let them near white women. And so in spite of all this horrific humiliation and outright sabotage, they ended up coming home as one of the most decorated units in the entire United States Army. Who is not going to fall in love with that story?
Well, why don't we end with a track by James Reese Europe, the band leader who was in the Harlem Hellfighters. And I was thinking,
Let's talk a little bit about Jim Europe, because I think the character of Jim Europe is incomprehensible to America's modern culture of celebrity. You know, nowadays you're a celebrity for celebrity's sake. That wasn't Jim Europe. He was a mega celebrity of the day. For a black guy to be honored and applauded wherever he went in white society was unheard of. And he gave all that up to form the regimental band of the Harlem Hellfighters on the condition that when the shooting started, he would put down his baton and pick up a machine gun. And he was the captain of a machine gun company in the trenches. And so he introduced, not only did he single-handedly introduce something called Le Jazz Hot to France, he then literally fought in the trenches to protect the French people with his life.
It's such a great story. So this is called Castle House Rag, and I think it's kind of almost avant-garde. The rhythms are so great on this. This recording is from 1914, so why don't we hear that? And Max Brooks, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been amazing to hear what you have to say.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's James Reese Europe's band. Max Brooks' new novel, Minecraft: The Island, is inspired by the video game Minecraft.